Okay. Welcome, everybody, to the Parsha class, Parshas Korach 5770. We are back now to our topic of the year, which is Tefillah. The last 3 weeks, we were on our way back to Tefillah. And with a tour from Rabbi Shlomo Wolbe, of blessed memory. So, we had been learning from the Sefer Sha'arim B'Tefillah by Rabbi Pinkus, and I have to tell you the truth, I have not looked into it yet. There's much more to learn from it. But I did have a message, an idea that occurred to me, relevant to Tefillah, which I would like to share with you, and that is based on another Sefer which I've never ever quoted because I don't know much about it, and that is the Sefer HaTanya, which you may associate with Chabad because it was written by the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Liadi, who's known as the Alter Rebbe, you know, from the 1700s. And he wrote the Sefer called, well, there's a book called Lessons in Tanya. That's the one that I looked at. But he wrote an original Hebrew called Tanya. He's known as the Baal HaTanya, the author of Tanya. And I looked a little bit into it. It's based on Kabbalah. It's based on the writings of the Arizal. But something, you know, everybody who's a member of the Chabad movement carries around a little but thick Sefer called the Chitas, which is acronym for Chumash, Tehillim, and Tanya. So it's kind of like every man's Bible, and I'm just curious to know what it says. It's not only for Chabad. I mean, the Alter Rebbe was a great scholar. He wrote a very important halachic work called the Shulchan Aruch Harav, which is quoted time and again by the Mishnah Brura, the Ruch Chofetz Chaim. And the Tanya was Sefer HaTanya was a Sefer that was written about philosophy and Jewish thought, not a halachic work. But Rabbi Ruderman, for example, was well versed in the Tanya. I think his father was from the Lubavitch Hasidim. My disclaimer is that the fact that I'm going to quote something from the Tanya does not mean that I'm a Hasid, and it does not mean that I'm Chabad. But also heard somebody saw me learning it, so they sent me a link to a series of classes by Rabbi Yosef Bechofer called Tanya for Misnagdim. Misnagdim means the opposers to Hasidim. And he gives many, many classes on different topics in Or Sameach, and he has a few classes, Tanya for Misnagdim. So I clicked on, I happen to know Rav Yosef from Ner Yisrael from years back. He was at my engagement party, the one that was hosted by our future Mechutanim, the Neuburgers. And he says that the Tanya has several sections, and he's not going to talk about the first section, a couple of sections. He says, because they're too depressing. Mm-hmm. Why are they depressing? Because basically, according to the Baal HaTanya, we're all Rishoyim, we're all wicked. We're not even Beinonim, we're not even the middle of the road. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that as we come up. So he starts off one of the later sections talking about the unity of God. But I am going to mention some of this idea about Beinoni and the Russia, etc. But first, a word from our Parsha. We have Parshas Korach. Parshas Korach is the story, one of the stories in the book of Bamidbar, which is unfortunate because it revolves around what we would call bad midos, bad character traits. An ugly dispute, a dissension that broke out among the Jewish people, among some of the leaders. A scathing criticism of Moshe and Aaron. And it's ugly, and it ends ugly, the death of hundreds of people. But those of you who have attended this class in previous years may remember that in general, in these parshios, so these several weeks, there seems to be a lot of bad midos, a lot of negative qualities. I was listening on the CD, and 2 years ago when we were learning selections from Mesilas Yesharim, from the Path of the Just, by Rabbi Luzzatto, we dedicated these three or four parshios to Rabbi Luzzatto's writings of the negative character traits. And so I thought that it would be apropos to connect what I'm going to tell you about prayer with the concept of bad midos. First of all, let me just quote, and we've quoted this before, from Rabbi Luzzatto, in the virtue of nikius, of cleanliness, which is where a Jew already being more or less observant of the commandments seeks to raise it to a higher level and to really be more clean, more scrupulous about fulfilling the precepts in all of their details. And he says that as we discuss mitzvos, we also have to discuss midos. Mitzvos is the actions that we take in the service of God. Midos are the personal qualities. And he says, for example, on page 78, just as cleanliness is required in one's actions, it is also required in one's character development. In fact, it is almost more difficult to apply it to one's character development than to one's actions. This is because a person's nature has a stronger effect on his character development than on his actions, due to the makeup of his temperament and personality, which can either be of great assistance or resistance to character development. So our midos are a little bit are closer to us than our actions. They're more inextricably bound to who we are, and therefore it's something much more ingrained. In summarizing what are the negative midos, he lists four. He lists four, the most prevalent. Gava, pride, negative pride. Kaas, anger. Kina, envy. And tava, lust. Later on, he breaks tava, lust, into two branches. There is tavas hamamon, lust for possession, and tavas hakovod, lust for honor. The way this ties into the parshios of Bamidbar is because he says, and this is throughout our history, many great men have fallen because of these midos, because of these character traits. And he cites, well, Rashi tells us that Korach's uprising started because of envy. Rashi tells us at the beginning of the Parsha, he says, "Uma ra'a Korach lachlok Moshe." What did Korach see to rise up and to take issue with Moshe? Niskane al nisiuso shel Elitzafan ben Uziel. He became envious over the princeship of Elitzafan, son of Uziel, who was a cousin of Korach. Sheminahu Moshe nasi al bnei Kohas, who Moshe had appointed Elitzafan as the prince over the branch of the Levite tribe from Levi's son Kohas, al pi hadibur, and Moshe did so with direct instructions from God, so it wasn't Moshe's choice. And Korach took issue with that. He said, "My father was one of four brothers. Kahas had four sons. Amram was the father of Moshe and Aaron. Fine. So they are the descendants of the Bechor, of the oldest. They get their positions. And then I, who am the son of Yitzhar, which is the second born, I should have gotten a position. Instead, Elitzaphan, son of Uziel, I think was the youngest of the four sons. So why is he giving the Nasius, the princeship, to him? What about me? It started off with envy, Rashi says. Rabbi Luzzatto says that that was envy mixed with kavod, tavas hakavod, the desire for honor. And Rabbi Luzzatto emphasizes that this is one of the strongest forces in a human being, is tavas hakavod, the desire for kavod, for honor. Now, this is not knocking the human need for kavod. Every person must have respect and self-respect and respect from others, but the desire for kavod, the desire for acclaim and fame and accolade, this is something which spins into gross proportions and can be the downfall of a man. And he says, who caused, page 87, who caused Korach to perish, and along with him his whole entourage? It was only the desire for honor, as is stated explicitly in Bamidbar in the Parsha. And now you wish to have the priesthood as well? Moshe looked into the soul of Korach and he said, what you are saying, you want to have the princeship, really you want to be the high priest. And you won't be satisfied until you do. That is desire for kavod. And it started with the Korach seeing Elitzaphan ben Uziel chosen as leader of the tribe. And then he says, and this was also, the desire for honor was also what led to the downfall of the spies of last week's parsha of Shalach. The spies slandering the land of Israel. This was brought about by their fear that their honor might be diminished upon entering Eretz Yisrael, because others might replace them as Israel's Nesiim, leaders of the tribes. This kernel, what drives us, even the greatest men, this desire for honor. So these are the bad midos. And, you know, it's not something taboo. We talk about it because we all have it. We're all born with, these are natural inclinations that we have. We get angry, we become envious, we seek honor, we seek possession. And I don't know if you're like me, when I hear this discussion, I kind of shy away and I kind of shrug my shoulders, throw up my hands and say, you know, what can you really do about it? It's who we are. It's part of us. It's just who we are. There's no way to lick it. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was often said, it's easier for a man to study the entire Talmud than to change a midah, than to change a personality trait. It's just so ingrained in us. Like Rabbi Luzzatto says, how can you even change? Throw up our hands, give up the fight. What are we to do? But the Baal HaTanya teaches us, I think, which is a great secret. A secret that has to do with prayer. And that's what I'm going to share with you. So let's go back to that question about who is, you know, the sages talk about three classes of people. There's the tzaddikim, the righteous, the beinonim, the middle of the road, and the rishayim, the wicked. Who are they? What are the qualifications for each one? So the standard approach, and this is implied in the Talmud, is that it has to do with how many mitzvahs and how many averis, how many good deeds, how many bad deeds. And everyone imagines the scale. Of course, we don't know the weight of different mitzvahs. You know, there's There's some mitzvahs that may be heavier, that may count for more. And of course, God takes into account the circumstances and the orientation of the person. But generally speaking, we understand a tzaddik is somebody that has more mitzvahs, a rasha is a person that has more averas, and a beinoni is somebody who balances out. The Baal HaTanya takes a different approach, which I believe is also rooted in Chazal, in the teachings of our sages. And this is the part that Rabbi Bechofer says is depressing. But don't worry, I don't think we had any high hopes about this anyway, what I'm going to tell you. But what's going to emerge from that is the secret. The Baal HaTanya says that the measure of tzaddik or beinoni is the following. A beinoni is somebody who doesn't do any averas, doesn't do any sins. None whatsoever. That's a beinoni. That's the middle of the road. Yes, you heard me right. The beinoni is the person who doesn't do any averos, not in action, not in thought, not in word. The rasha is the one who allows himself to do an avera. One. Okay. So what's the difference between a beinoni and a tzaddik? If a beinoni doesn't do any sins, his slate is clean, what more could be a tzaddik? So here's where we have to study a little bit from the Baal HaTanya. Starting on page 175, Lessons in Tanya. Is that where it starts? No, it starts on page 169. The Beinoni, the Alter Rebbe explains, some of this is the editor. This is called Lessons in Tanya, where they took the words of the original book, translated it, and then added many, explanatory notes, or really paragraphs. The Beinoni is one whose practical conduct in thought, speech, and action is dictated solely by the divine soul. It has the upper hand over the animal soul. The Beinoni accomplishes this by not allowing himself to be dominated in any way by the animal soul, even for the shortest duration, never thinking, speaking, and surely not acting in a sinful manner. Never. The garments of the divine soul alone, namely thought, speech, and action, in Torah and mitzvos, are those used by the Beinoni. So, the Beinoni only manifests the mitzvah. Nevertheless, with respect to the essence of the divine and animal souls, i.e. their respective faculties of intellect and emotion, in other words, how the person feels, and here is a difficult point. He says the Beinoni doesn't even allow himself to sin with thought, but what that means, I think, is that he doesn't dwell on his sinful thoughts. But he has them. He has sinful thoughts and emotions. In that area, for the Beinoni, the divine soul does not dominate the animal soul. The latter, the animal soul, remains powerful enough to arouse desires for physical matters. However, through constant vigilance, the Beinoni keeps these desires in check, never permitting them any practical manifestation. So what is the Beinoni? The Beinoni is the person who doesn't let himself practice what he thinks. Or he doesn't even allow himself to dwell on those sinful thoughts. He quickly dismisses them, but he has them. The tzaddik, then, is the person, by implication, who has dominated, his divine soul has dominated the animal soul so much that he has eradicated those sinful thoughts and emotions entirely from his being. That. Now, it's very depressing because according to what Rabbi Bechofer says, is it so matter-of-factly, we don't like studying the beginning of the Tanya because according to him, we're all Rishayim. So let's go on to part 4 or 5. He just dismisses it like that because everyone's a Russia because everyone sins. Okay, so what's the secret? The secret is this. The faculties of the animal soul exercise some degree of control over the body through awakening in one's heart desires for worldly pleasures, which in turn causes forbidden thoughts to enter his mind. Only at specific times do the faculties of the divine soul hold undisputed sovereignty over the Beinoni, with the animal soul having no effect whatever on him. There are times when the Beinoni can crawl into the space of a tzaddik. Guess when those times are? That's like I'll take the slot not to speak Lashon Hara between 3 and 4 a.m. I'll take that slot on the during the recital of the Shema or the Amida. At this time of prayer, the supernal intellect above is in a sublime state. It is a time of great spiritual illumination in the higher spiritual worlds. Likewise, below, in this physical world, the time of prayer is propitious for every man to ascend to a higher spiritual level. Then, during the recital of Shema, or during prayer, the Beinoni binds his intellectual faculties, consisting of Chachma, Bina, and Das, which are the words that form the acronym Chabad, by the way, meditating deeply on the greatness of the Blessed One, arousing through his meditation a burning love of God in the right part of his heart, some terminology which he has. This love in turn leads the Beinoni to desire to cleave to him by means of fulfilling the Torah and its commandments out of love. The realization that only the fulfillment of Torah and mitzvot will fulfill his desire to become one with God's channels, the Beinoni's love into a... The realization that only the fulfillment of Torah and mitzvot will fulfill his desire to become one with God channels the Beinoni's love into a desire to observe Torah and mitzvot. This arousal of love for God and its accompanying resolve to adhere to Torah and mitzvot and thereby to cleave to him is the essential subject of the Shema, which biblical commandment enjoins us to recite. That's what the Shema is. I pledge allegiance to the oneness of God. I profess my love of God and my desire and my commitment to observe his mitzvot. Remember last week, Rabbi Wolbe says that the first hurdle for mitzvah observance are the signs. The signs, those mitzvahs that are like signs with God, the tefillin. And also he connects the tzitzis and the mezuzah. It's all in the Shema. The Shema is an allegiance, a statement of desire to these commandments, to connecting with God. And what is prayer for that follows closely after the Shema? The rabbinically ordained blessings preceding and following the Shema, first there are blessings that precede and follow the Shema. They are a preparation, enabling us to fulfill that which we recite in the Shema, as explained elsewhere. And then we have the prayer itself, the Shmona Esrei. During prayer, the Beinoni's divine soul is his undisputed sovereign. Now, does it last? No, it doesn't last. It's like going into anesthesia. You know, while the anesthesia is effective, you don't feel the pain. It wears off, you feel it again. And that's the same thing with the Shema and the Shemoneh Esrei. It's not intended to last. Shabbat. Can you imagine? Can you imagine every day, twice a day, three times a day, going into a state where we become so, where our divine soul becomes dominant, where it pushes away all desires for the forbidden, all desires for gava, pride, kina, envy, kas, anger, tava, lust for possession or for honor. Can you imagine climbing up to a mountain every day, three times a day, and saying the Shema and davening, and at that time you are supreme. The divine soul is supreme. At that moment, you look down at the world and you say, I don't feel those desires now. Hey, I want to be close to God. I want to fulfill His mitzvos. Even though you know that as soon as you finish the Shema, and as soon as you finish the Shemoneh Esrei, you're going to be down on the ground again. As he says, this state of affair lasts only for the duration of the spiritually charged time of prayer. After prayer, however, when the intellect of the Blessed One is no longer in a state of sublimity, when the spiritual illumination engendered by prayer ceases, the evil of the animal soul reawakens. The Beinoni once again feels a desire for the lusts of this world and its delights. Since the evil of the Beinoni's animal soul remains undiminished even after prayer, as the Alter Rebbe will explain shortly. That's the power of prayer. That's the secret. The secret is that prayer, we once spoke about how when you're davening, you're standing before Hashem. Well, this is the counterpart of that. When you're davening, your divine soul is at the top. And although we can't even imagine being on this level, we can't even imagine being on the level of a Beinoni, let alone a Tzaddik. But during the time of prayer, a person can be there. And what's the use? What's the point if it's just going to be temporary? I don't know, but try it. I have a suspicion that it would make a profound difference in what we do before and after. The fact that every day we know we can have that prayer session and we can transform ourselves even for that temporary amount of time. We can think about things that we until now maybe never even dared thinking because we thought it's useless, it's futile. During prayer you can think that way. If we've never thought of observing certain mitzvos, think about them when you're davening. Fantasize about them. Because it's not a lie, it's true. It's your inborn divine soul that is speaking the truth. Rabbi Wolbe told us that any aspect of denial and any aspect of refusal or of unwillingness to follow the Torah and the commandments is because there is a crust that is formed around our hearts and is not allowing us to be who we really are. On tefillah, when we pray, when we say the Shema, we can and we are authorized and empowered to take that crust off and to think and dream about who we really are. And to think about those things that we never dare think about. That is the secret that I learned from the Baal HaTanya relevant to tefillah. And that's what I wanted to share with you.
Now,
and I finished 10 minutes early.
You talk about the animal soul as if it's negative. I mean, there are positive aspects to the animal soul. It gives us drive, you know.
Good. Very good. Very good point, Dan.
You've emphasized the negative only.
So I think that the animal soul is a positive force when it is directed by the divine soul. It's kind of like a horse. If you've trained it and you're able to ride it, it can take you where you need to go. But if it's not trained and it's just wild, then it's going to hurt someone. And that's the same thing. We have an animal soul within us. The tzaddik also has the animal soul, but it's dominated by the divine soul, even in his emotions. In other words, he's able to muster his human power and use his God-given gifts and talents to do mitzvahs and to think about mitzvahs, and he does it. It doesn't take him away. But the animal soul, when left on its own or when allowed to dominate, does pull a person away from God. So it's not in and of itself bad, but it has the if it's not held in check and not dominated, then it leads us in the wrong direction. That's a very, very, very good point. Yeah.
When you mentioned about praying, being elevated, and it's a temporary thing, and then we return to that state that we were prior to prayer, I feel like my personal experience is that I may not be in that same place when I'm in that state of prayer, but nor do I actually return to where I was prior to being in that state of prayer. So it takes me someplace and helps me evolve in some way that I didn't have before. As long as I continue on that path with intention and with a state of consciousness rather than doing something mechanical, then I do experience that transformation.
So it will put you at a different place when you're finished too. Very good.
You know, I would think that I want to question the question thing. During prayer, you elevate it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't agree that when you finish prayer, it leaves.
You're back.
Overflows. It overflows.
Very
and that's
good.
Why you have to do it over and over.
Very good.
In the morning, in the afternoon, once a day, or once a week, or once a year. But it overflows. So you pray, you get on a divine level, and then you can conduct your life until the next time you pray and you get into those kind of thoughts. So that's the only
okay. So you're saying basically the same idea that prayer has a lasting effect.
Yeah.
You've always talked about this stepping up in your spirituality, and this is just another thing, increasing your base level. Just another step.
Yeah, I never thought of prayer as being that powerful. In other words, I don't know. I guess you could say Torah study is the same. It'd be interesting what the Baal HaTanya would say about Torah study, but to say that there is a mitzvah that you can do, and of course this presupposes that you're concentrating on your tefillah and your mind isn't back there with the animal soul, but you can use prayer as a chance to put you on a very high level. Spiritually, and to give rein to your divine soul. That's I don't think you have that by the other mitzvahs. When you're doing the mitzvah of whatever it may be, giving tzedakah, you know, you could be giving the tzedakah with your right hand and thinking, why doesn't this guy just get a job? You know, at the same time that you're doing the mitzvah, or when you're blowing the shofar, you're saying, why don't they get a new baal tekiah already? This guy can, you know. So, but prayer is something which takes your concentration, and if you focus on the words, you're able to rise above, and that's very powerful.
Well, the other comment about the Yetzer Hara, the animal urge or the evil urge, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole section in the Talmud where they talk about controlling or getting rid of the evil inclination. It doesn't work. If you do that, the world won't exist. You have to have a Yetzer Hara, or an evil inclination, or an animal instinct to drive, to strive, to reproduce.
Right, that's what Dan was saying, right? Yeah, that's like the, you know, the story in the Talmud where there used to be a very, very strong drive to serve idols. We spoke about that once, Rabbi Weinberg's words on that topic. But it was getting so unbearable that people could not pull themselves away, and so they prayed. They had the men of the great assembly pray that he should remove this inclination from our hearts, and he did. And then they said, wow, that worked. So they said, we're also having a problem with promiscuity. And they prayed that God should take that away also. And he did. But the problem was, the next morning there were no eggs for breakfast. And the people said, this isn't going to work. And so they said, God, put it back.
Plus, it sort of negates the power to choose. I mean,
right.
God gives us
absolutely,
the absence
absolutely.
Of the yetzer hara, the whole notion of
absolutely.
Free will is negated.
Absolutely. Dan, and then Dr. Schultz.
Mike was first. When you compared the animal soul in your analogy to a horse that's trained or untrained, which is very apt analogy, it made me think of the passage in one of the blessings of the Shema that speaks about a yoke that we accept. I'm not sure of the exact passage, but in order to mm-hmm. undertake relationship with God, we have to have a discipline and have a yoke mm-hmm. about us, mm-hmm. just the way untrained animals have mm-hmm. yokes.
I think Ol Malchus Shamayim was when the angels they accept the yoke of the kingdom of heaven from each other. Is it that phrase?
I believe so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's another reason why we have to have eggs, so we can have yolks. Okay. Yolks on me. Okay, Dan.
Is the difference between a Benoni and a Tzaddik the degree of spiritual control over the animal soul?
Well, imagine, so you know what a tzaddik is? A tzaddik is a person who's on the level that the Benoni is on during prayer, but he's on that level all the time. That's what the Rebbe says. That the tzaddik always focuses his thoughts on the divine soul. And the Benoni, when he's at rest, doesn't. But when he prays, he can elevate himself to that level. The tzaddik is on that level all the time.
No negative thoughts ever, or the divine soul just can cut that out.
He says that you don't cut it out. What you do is you replace it. I think that's what the theory is on addiction, is you can't take something away, you have to replace it. He says there is the ability for a person to get so much pleasure, so much ecstasy from connecting with Hashem through Torah and mitzvos and general purpose, that he is in a state of ecstasy which is so pleasurable that he doesn't desire the other things. And that's the theory. So the tzaddik is becoming like a muscle man. He's constantly developing himself, and when he develops himself, it's not just a question of being disciplined, it's a question of developing a love for God, which is so strong that it replaces the love for other things. I mean, the Talmud says of one sage, and it's debatable whether a person is really allowed to do this, but there was one sage, now we don't, in our religion, we do not promote celibacy. We know that. Right? That is the big difference between Judaism and other things. But there was one sage, he lived at the time of the Hillel, at that era, his name was Ben Azai, and he did not get married, and he chose not to fulfill the mitzvah of pru or vu, be fruitful and multiply. And the rabbis questioned him, and he says, "What can I do? Nafshi chashka b'Torah. My soul desires and clings to your Torah. I have no desire to get married." Now, again, maybe God planted this individual in the world just to teach us that the Torah can be something which is very, very fulfilling and satisfying. But not that we should actually act that way. But it's possible. So it's replacing. And that can happen on any level. Because imagine, I'm glad you brought that up, for a Russia. If a person is constantly overcome by temporal worldly desires or desires for the forbidden. So let him try to develop a taste of something spiritual, and that will give him a substitute on one level. None of this is all or nothing. That's the way it works. The way it works is as you catch on, as you grab onto something divine, a mitzvah, Torah, tefillah, it suddenly satisfies you and gives you a pleasure which you didn't have before. And that pleasure is certain to offset another pleasure that you had. So we can take this on any level, in any increment. Yeah.
With going back to your horse analogy, it's easy to think, you have to take control of the Yetzer Hara, take control of the horse. But that's like the most basic level. I mean, if you think of watching people ride a horse, you got a person who knows absolutely nothing, and the horse, if it's a wild horse, you're done for. And if it's not a wild horse, it's going to do what it wants with you anyway. But at least it's not necessarily going to go against your way.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do take some control over a horse, okay, so you take some control. But the ultimate is like, if you watch these people that do dressage or something like that, and just by moving the knees, mm-hmm. they get the horse to go down, go mm-hmm. up, do their legs in a totally contrary to mm-hmm. nature thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's where the tzaddik is.
Mm-hmm.
He has become like, in a bad, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but when you see a person who's really at one with the horse,
mm-hmm.
the horse has become part of him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tzaddik level. Mm-hmm. And it takes training to be that. Mm-hmm. You can't just say, well, I'm going to take control.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, what Torah is for, is to give you that training.
Good. Thank you. What? Well, I mean, on this analogy, a person is like a horse on a horse and rider. Yeah. Of course, we've got that horse inside of us, so we don't really. That's just an analogy, but we've all got the horse. Yeah. Eshkola. I was just horsing around with you. Yes, yes. Thank you very much. And I didn't say anything, and I started the class, and I should have.
Shem
knows. Okay. This is for the merit of Malka Yaakova Bas Moshe in the learning today.
Thank you.
But that doesn't help me.
You know Chicago
My father had a dress.